This edition of Monocle on Saturday was first broadcast on the 20th of April, 2024. I'm Georgina Godwin, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. This is Monocle on Saturday. Coming up on today's programme, we look through the week's news and culture with Isabel Hilton, the journalist and founder of China Dialogue. Then we'll head to the Venice Biennale, where Turkish artist Gülsün Kara Mustafa speaks to Monocle about her exhibition Hollow and Broken, A State of the World. Then,
I would say it's like what happened with cooks that became chefs or tailors that became stylists. And these workers in our industry are craftsmen that create beautiful things.
Monocle's Nick Manise sits down with Nicola Coropoulos, the CEO of renowned Italian furniture company Poltrona Frau. And that's all ahead here on Monocle on Saturday. First, though, here's the news. Yesterday, the US House of Representatives advanced a $95 billion legislative package providing aid to Ukraine, Israel and the Indo-Pacific in a broad bipartisan vote, overcoming hardline Republican opposition that held it up for months. If the House passes the measure, as expected, the Senate will need to follow suit to send it to the President to sign into law. President Volodymyr Zelensky told NATO members on Friday that Ukraine needed a minimum of 7 Patriot or other high-end air defence systems to counter Russian airstrikes, exhorting them to step up their military assistance for Kyiv. NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg said after the meeting between Allied defence ministers and Zelensky that the Allies had agreed to provide Kyiv with additional air defence systems. And Iran's foreign minister on Friday said Tehran was investigating an attack on Iran, adding that so far a link to Israel had not been proven, as he downplayed the strike. Iranian media and officials referred to the incident as an attack by infiltrators rather than by Israel, obviating the need for retaliation. And that's your Monocle Radio News. Hello and welcome to Monocle on Saturday, and I'm joined in the studio by Isabel Hilton, journalist and founder of China Dialogue. Welcome to you, Isabel.
Wonderful to be here.
Thanks so much for coming in. China, of course, is your USP, as they might say. So let's start with the China story, because the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz went off to China. He was trying to promote German business interests and deliver warnings from Europe, and it didn't really go that well.
No, it played rather badly, particularly in Brussels, where an increasingly robust line has been taken on China, in particular with regard to some new energy products like connected vehicles, electric vehicles, solar panel chips and batteries. And Scholz's problem is that he is monumentally unpopular at home. The coalition is very, very fragile, and his approval ratings are on the floor, and the German economy is in recession. It used to be the big driver of the European Union. So the German economy has done extremely well in China for the past 25, 30 years, but that is coming to an end. And what we're seeing is that the kind of advanced engineering that Germany's very good at, the Chinese have learned how to do, not least because of this German partnership, and they have moved on to things like electric vehicles, which German companies have been very slow on. So, frankly, Germany's getting it in both sides. Now, Scholz's response to this has been to go off and be very nice to the Chinese in the hope that they will provide the kind of stimulus to the German economy that they used to. But there are lots of risks here. One is that, China continues to support Russia in its adventure in Ukraine. And it was Scholz's party that was the most pro-Russian and the most keen on the idea that if you engage economically, you get a political payoff. So, it was changed through trade was the kind of German slogan. which was thoroughly discredited when Putin invaded Ukraine and his full-scale invasion, leaving Germany with terrible dependencies for energy that they had to scramble to undo. And the same pattern is being repeated with China. Mm. So there are geostrategic risks with China, not least around its role in the Middle East, but also, of course, over Taiwan and over Ukraine. And Germany's dependence couldn't have been more clearly illustrated in this visit, where essentially Scholz is going and saying, please don't worry about, you know, the hard line from Brussels. We want to continue to do business. Mm. But it's a shrinking market share for Germany and increasing competition in home markets. And it has pretty much, you know, lobbed a grenade at Brussels, at von der Leyen's policy.
Mm. How much influence does China have over Iran?
Well, that's much debated. It takes 85-90% of Iran's oil. And remember that Iran is subject to UN sanctions over oil. So China is in breach of those sanctions. They're shipped in kind of dark ships to, the oil is shipped in dark ships to China, where it is refined in small provincial refineries. So they try to make it relatively untraceable. It's also paid for not in dollars. So, you know, the leverage that the international system has over this trade is pretty low. You might think that created a degree of dependency on China for Iran that would give China quite a lot of influence. But if China does have a lot of influence, there's not a lot of sign of it. Mm. China really doesn't want trouble in the Middle East. And, you know, Iran, I think, has been playing it quite cannily in the last week. But it's not at all clear that that is the result of Chinese pressure. Mm. And it seems to me that neither of the big powers, the United States is exercising remarkably little restraint on Israel, because Netanyahu prioritizes his own political survival. And he's got a coalition, as we know, of very hardline right-wing supporters. And if he breaks that, he's out of power and in lots of other trouble. So he's prioritizing that in everything he does. And the United States seems helpless in the face of that determination of Netanyahu to survive in that way.
And, of course, what's happened with this strike on Iran, or the Iranian strike on Israel, and the way Iran's not really reacting to it. Yeah. But one of the sort of side effects of that is, of course, Gaza has fallen down the news agenda.
Absolutely.
And we're just seeing here in Tortoise Media, it's talking about how a renowned Palestinian journalist who's been covering Gaza for 10 years has left because he's becoming a target.
And I think that this is, I mean, it's one of a series of very worrying manifestations that Israel just doesn't want Gaza reported. I mean, it's essentially, we have mass murder going on in Gaza. We have promises to increase the supply of aid, which somehow don't get fulfilled. I mean, it's only marginally increased. We have imminent starvation. We have the breakdown of all public health systems as a result of Israeli action. And less of that is being reported. Gaza has been the most dangerous place for journalists to report for almost in living memory. Mm. They are targeted. Foreign journalists are not allowed in. So it's fallen very, very heavily on Palestinians who have died in large numbers and whose families have been killed. And this is, you know, this is a, if this is meant to be the defence of democracy, it doesn't look very convincing.
No, absolutely not. Now, there's a new film out which has journalists at its heart. Fairly unconvincing journalists, I'm told. I haven't actually seen it. We're talking about Civil War. You've seen it. Tell us the premise.
Well, the premise is it's set in some undefined future where there is a president in the White House who we see him right at the end, and he is the implication is that his politics are Trump-like, but Trump in extreme. There is a coalition of Western states who are trying to overthrow his presidency. So we have civil war in the United States, and it is a pretty dystopian scene. It's kind of interesting because, you know, it for me it was not unconvincing as a scenario of how, were we to get to that awful point, how a civil war would play out. So, you know, as we know, civil America is very heavily armed. So you get, you know, it's all too easy to imagine civil war, you know, taking hold very, very easily since there is so much weaponry lying around in cupboards. But for me, the kind of irritating thing was that in order to carry the plot, in order to take us through this, you know, extensive dark battlefield, you needed some characters, and they have they lighted on four journalists. So three of them were photojournalists, one elderly who came along with a seasoned female photojournalist and a rookie female photojournalist and a man who was basically playing the role of driver. I guess my problem with these characters was that I don't know if you find this, but I find journalists as played in Hollywood kind of unconvincing because they don't do anything that journalists do, you know, they like file stories, you know. So these two characters, four characters, are making their way through the battlefield. The young woman photojournalist is doing crazy things because she's trying to, you know, make her name. She's also shooting with a camera that uses film. And I think, well, if we were meant to be in the future, how is she going to, you know, develop or get this film physically back to the office? But we don't really see any of that, nor do we see anyone filing any words or, you know. What we do see is them dashing in and out of various unpleasant situations, risking their lives, and only two of them make it to the end.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, sorry about that. I won't tell you which two. But there is a great closing line when which I think I have heard repeated elsewhere, so it's not a spoiler. So they finally, you get into the Oval Office, you know, the troops burst in, the president is finally kind of on the floor with a gun to his head, and the journalist who works for Reuters sideline says, "Wait," and you think, is he going to say, "Don't shoot him"? And he says, "I need a quote." And to which the president replies, "Don't let them kill me." And there's a pause. He says, "That'll do." That is a good line.
That's an excellent line. Of course, that film actually premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival, a very big film festival. But another big film festival that we often talk about here is Venice, where you see a lot of wonderful films previewing. And of course, right now, Venice is hosting the Biennale, the Art Biennale. So contemporary art's never shied away from engaging with global politics. And this year's Venice Biennale is no different. Lots of pavilions reflect the turbulent state of current global politics. And one powerful example is Turkey. The artist representing the country this year, Gulsun Kara Mustafa, is known for her work that explores socio-political issues. In the 1970s, she was sentenced to 6 months in prison for aiding and abetting political activists. Her exhibition, Hollow and Broken, A State of the World, at the Venice Biennale, which starts today, includes an installation of large chandeliers made from shattered Venetian glass, which symbolise the historically fragile conflicts between global regions. Here, Kara Mustafa tells us more.
These are not ordinary chandeliers. Actually, they're all dedicated to one of the monotheistic beliefs, which is the Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Why did I choose this theme in my project? I was not in a good mood while I was doing it. For example, by the time I was informed about this project, that I can do this in this space, the thing is, there is a war going on in Ukraine. And also, big earthquake happened in the south of Turkey and Syria, an earthquake with 50,000 people dead. And later, there blasted another war, which was not very pleasant at all. So I thought, you know, how can I feel within this atmosphere? It is just hollowness. I feel that the world has gone into a hollow position. And my feelings are broken. And how can I express myself these broken feelings and the continuation? I was in Venice. Well, in Venice, there was a way of expressing myself. Yes, Venice was very famous with its beautiful glass, Venetian glass, which I was fascinated from childhood. Yes, I had to put one part of it into my project. The second part would be, you know, how can I lead myself to this Venetian glass and what can I do with it? The other thing I felt at this point in this venue, the venue is important because this was the artillery building of the whole arsenal. And our space as Turkey Pavilion is the Sale d'Armi. It means that this was a display place for the arms. Whenever they produced arms, they were displaying them. But actually, you know, this idea of wars, idea of this place that I am in, Venetian glass, and also an additional situation for that was I was feeling like I was in Istanbul's the Byzantine Hippodrome. You know that in Hippodrome, the Byzantine Hippodrome, there are three columns which go, the dates go back to the early Byzantine, and they're supposed to come and given as presents from Egypt. This is a fantastic story, and these columns are still there.
And that was Gulsen Kara Mustafa representing Turkey at this year's Venice Biennale, discussing her exhibition Hollow and Broken, A State of the World. Well, still with me is Isabel Hilton. Hollow and Broken, A State of the Tory Party might be something we could say here because, gosh, these stories coming out. We're mostly talking about this Tory MP who clearly went off the rails, but a long time ago and nothing's been done.
Absolutely. This man, Mark Menzies. I mean, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. This story broke because his 78-year-old former campaign manager got a call from him at 3 a.m. and he claimed to have been locked into a flat by bad people who were demanding £5,000 to release him. And could she cough up? She declined. But in the morning, the price had gone up. It was more than £6,000 by then. And another of his staff did cash in an ISA in order to pay this. She was subsequently reimbursed. But the whole thing was absolutely bizarre. And it turns out that Mark Menzies, who has now had the whip removed, but he was a trade envoy. I mean, he wasn't just an ordinary backbencher. He was a trade envoy for the UK. But he has a long history of drunken episodes, of very questionable behaviour, and of, you know, diverting funds given by supporters and donors to his campaign into what appear to be personal expenses. In one case, some years back, quite a lot of, I mean, several thousand pounds, it was used for what were claimed as medical emergency. Well, we do have a National Health Service. And in any event, that's not why people give money to his campaign. So the police are now investigating. But he's joining a substantial number of MPs who have had not just the Tory party, but from all parties who've had the whip removed and who continue to sit in the House of Commons with various shapes and sizes of cloud hanging over their heads.
And I mean, it turns out that the Prime Minister knew about this.
Well, that's all pretty shocking. And certainly the dedicated, you know, constituency workers were pretty appalled at the way the party has handled this. Because this woman, you know, who has worked for the party all her life, went to the Tory central administration and said, you know, told them what was going on, and nothing happened. So it didn't happen, as we've seen repeatedly with British scandals, until the story broke in the press and the party were forced to act. But this is an absolute shambles, you know. And you've got an election coming up where you're going to be asking people for money. I don't think this looks good at all.
No. Also, a mayoral election's coming up. Now, the Tory candidate for that is Susan Hall. And I see that the current mayor and her opponent in this Mr. Khan, Sadiq Khan, has been criticising her, saying she has a Trumpian attitude to climate, which is not great. To be fair, he says that that Xi is really going to take us backwards, basically, in terms of environmental and green policies, unlike in Paris. So Anne Hidalgo has a vision of a greener Paris. But she's not really getting the authorities on board, is she?
Well, there's been a fair bit of pushback. But actually, you know, Anne Hidalgo has been mayor of Paris for nearly 10 years now. I remember meeting her when Paris hosted the Conference of the Parties, the climate conference, which resulted in a really important deal. And she was very visible then. And she's been working hard ever since. And what she has managed to do in a city which was so in love with the car, you know, You had to be a very brave politician to challenge that. She has managed to get Parisians cycling and walking and using public transport as never before. I mean, I remember being in Paris once when there was a public transport strike, not an unusual event in France. And the car drivers were so determined to, you know, get where they needed to be that all the cafes, you know, were constantly having to move their chairs and tables off the pavement because the cars, you know, the cars took priority and nobody really questioned that. And that she has changed. Yeah. And I think all over Europe we are beginning to see these climate measures weaponized for electoral purposes. And certainly the ultra low emission zone in London came up in a recent by-election as a kind of useful wedge for anti-climate thinkers who tend to be on the right of the party. But Hidalgo, even if she is facing headwinds now, really has changed Paris.
Mm. Now, one thing she's also done recently is to say, I refuse to endorse this evil scheme. And she's talking about X. She says she's quitting X because it spreads disinformation, hatred, because it's become a gigantic global sewer that's toxic for democracy and constructive debate. And of course, this is a complaint that comes up often. And just more generally, in terms of how technology is kind of moving us on, AI, of course, is another reason why some people are now really quite, what would you call it, technophobic?
Yeah, I mean, I have some sympathy. In theory, AI ought to do wonderful things for us, like improving medical diagnosis and in all sorts of ways. But actually, it also has some very disturbing aspects. For instance, if you've tried to get onto a customer helpline with a major utility lately, as I have, it is a recipe for rage and frustration. There's a long piece in the FT today, which I really was cheering all the way through about the frustrations of trying to get through to what is a kind of fantasy of customer service if you have a problem that needs solving and you can't because there's no way to do it because if you spend an hour waiting in a queue, what you eventually get is a bot. Mm. And the bot has a limited range of responses. So that's one frustration. I also was slightly alarmed this week when I was using, I asked an AI, what do you call them? Well, you know, a bot, I guess, to find me an academic paper on a particular topic that I was researching. And ping, it came up with a response, which was fantastic. It was a well-known academic journal with the issue number and the page number and a précis of the article, which was sufficiently interesting that I wanted to read the whole piece. So I started looking for it. I spent about an hour, you know, trying to track down this article. I had the title, the author existed. But after about an hour of not finding it and going entirely through that issue of the journal, finding the page numbers didn't tally, I went back to the AI bot and said, this article doesn't exist. And it said, oh, yes, yeah, sorry. I made it up. I shouldn't have. Hang on a minute. You're supposed to make life better. You're supposed to be smart. But it was like being faced with a teenager who's trying, you know, to disguise the fact that they've been drinking gin in their bedroom. You know, so I won't do it again. It was absolutely extraordinary.
There was also an article in The Guardian this week saying that there's been a survey that finds generative AI is a major threat to the work of translators, literary translators particularly, and that more than a third of them have lost work due to generative AI.
Yes, and this is another area where I have sort of mixed emotions because translation has got hugely better in the last 10 years. I founded, well, back in 2006, I founded what was the world's first bilingual, fully bilingual Chinese-English website, which was on climate change. And at that point, we had to do all the translation by hand because the machine translation gave you gobbledygook, particularly in, you know, Chinese is not a particularly easy language to automate. So we employed a lot of very good and dedicated translators. These days, frankly, the machine translation is pretty good. And what I appreciate about it is that you can't speak all the languages. So I can now read and I can find and read articles in languages that I don't speak. And that I find immensely useful. On the other hand, in things like literary translation, I think it's a very different thing. Because the other thing about translation is it's not just about the words, as we found at the beginning of China Dialogue. It's about the style and cult. There are huge cultural influences on how things are written and how things are read and what appeals. Mm-hmm. And good translation, and you know all about literary translation, takes that into account, and that's a high-level skill.
Well, I'd like to bring in Samuel McDowell now. He's co-founder of Charco Press. It's a publishing house dedicated to translated Latin American literature. Charco won Publisher of the Year at Scotland's National Book Awards in 2023, and their books have won or been shortlisted for multiple awards, including the International Booker Prize. So the latest award came just this week when Of Cattle and Men by Brazilian writer Ana Paula Maia, translated by Zoe Perry, won the Republic of Consciousness Prize, which recognises books from small publishers. Samuel, many thanks for coming on. I know you've been listening to that discussion. Why will AI never kill real translators?
Hi, good morning, and it's nice to join you. I think just listening to the conversation there, I think there's some very valid points around trying to distinguish between, should we say, more utilitarian uses of AI for generating translations versus the more intricate challenges of translating works of literature. And referring to that article in the Guardian, where Thomas Bunstead, a translator, I think he did put it very well, talking about the idiomatic, knotty, and complex writing involved. There's a musicality, there's a cadence, there is the use of slang that might vary from one region to another, even within the same language. And I think those sorts of layers of intricacies, AI can't do well, at least at this stage. Yeah. However, I do see that that in terms of just being a useful tool for broadening communication, human communication, I think it's there is something there. So my view on it is that certainly the landscape is changing. In some areas there are benefits, and in other areas I think there's things to watch.
Mm. Now, I'd like to know more about your business. Tell us why you set up Charco Press.
So it started when we were living in South America, and as you no doubt are aware, that Latin America has a very rich literary history and a very vibrant scene. And we were just enthralled with a number of incredible authors that we saw that were producing these wonderful works of literature, and then we would look to see if they were available for readers of English, and they just weren't. It was basically born out of frustration that why should readers in the UK, readers in the US, or any English speaking part of the world be missing out on these incredible pieces of writing? So then we thought, well, if someone's going to do something about it, it might as well be us. So that's where it started.
And tell us about Of Cattle and Men, your latest prize winner.
Yeah, it's an incredible book. It's short. But perfectly weighted. It builds atmosphere. The writing style is just very, very tight, and I think just gets into the point of the book, which is set on a slaughterhouse in the interior of Brazil, and it's, you know, all the grimness that you can imagine that comes with that, and the cattle suddenly start acting a little bit strange. It's referred to quite often as a bit of a gut punch of a novel, and I think that's a very accurate description of it. It just really sort of hits you as you're reading it. And I think it's incredible how the author and translator have managed to produce such a powerful work in such a slim novel.
Samuel, thank you very much indeed. That was Samuel McDowell from Charco Press, and you're listening to Monocle on Saturday. And finally on today's show, we head to Milan's design fair, Salone del Mobile, where Monocle's design editor Nick Manise caught up with Nicola Coropoulos. Nicola is the CEO of Poltrona Frau, an Italian furniture company specialising in leather upholstery. Nick began by asking why Poltrona Frau has strong ties to continue its production in Tolentino.
One of the elements of the magic of Poltrona Frau is this very strong relationship with the territory, a territory that has been known for its long-last expertise in crafting leather, which goes back to the Middle Ages and has passed down from generation to generations over the year. And there are few companies that can boast Made in Italy sign that are yes, made in Italy, but entirely made in Italy. Actually, I would say that 99% of what comes with the Poltrona Frau brand is produced within a radius of 20 miles from where our premises are. The only exception being outdoor with teak that has necessarily come from Southeast Asia.
So is there, like, are you seeing multiple generations come and work for Poltrona Frau? How do you keep this expertise alive? Why do people still want to work in furniture? Why isn't everyone trying to be a Bitcoin trader or something else in Tolentino?
Certainly because this is a profession that has its appeal to younger generation. And we have created a strong connection with the local schools to already tell the young generations how nice it is to craft beautiful things. And we are about to create our Crafts Academy, where we will take advantage of the expertise of our retired craftsmen to teach young people. I would say it's like what happened with cooks that became chefs or tailors that became stylists. And these workers in our industry will or are craftsmen that create beautiful things.
I mean, the Craft Academy sounds like an amazing forward-looking project. What are Poltrona Frau's priorities heading forward? Where are you focusing your energy this year and beyond?
Well, certainly our main focus is to intercept the needs of changing consumers and to offer them solutions for their living that without losing the link with the tradition and the heritage that we bring forward is certainly an element of novelty. At the same time, we would like to couple good design with comfort and fashion, and these are attributes that are essential to make the success of good design.
How do you strike the balance between, I guess, good business and quality design? How do you find that line?
I'm a little bit sharp on this, and I believe that good business comes only if you have good quality and good design. I mean, good business is the consequence of good design. In other words, to have the results, you have to do your own work first.
So there's all these kind of different layers and different markets that you're operating in. I mean, how do you anticipate the furniture market growing and changing in the next year?
Well, our industry has enjoyed a very positive bubble soon after the COVID times, where home has actually became the center of everybody's thoughts and attention, because basically we were forced to live at home more than we had done in the previous years. I think that this bubble is now deflated, but at the same time, the understanding that having the home as a place that has to be comfortable, functional, pleasant to live, and hybrid to a certain extent, because you do not only live in there, but you also work in there. You have a lot of social interaction is a key element of consumer thinking. We expand our point of view. We may say that after COVID, after a period of freezing, all the activities related to public spaces have started and are now booming in different geographies. Think about the all the new developments that are happening in hospitality, where the meaning itself of hospitality has changed because customers are looking for customized, tailor-made solutions that can satisfy their needs. But also think about the world of airports. For 2 years, airports were actually empty, and now they show their inability to contain the number of people that are traveling. So they need to evolve, and we have to be there and give the right replies to these trends as well.
That was Nicola Koropoulos, CEO of Poltrona Frau, speaking to Monocle's design editor Nick Manise at Salone del Mobile. And that's all for this edition of Monocle on Saturday. Many thanks to our producer and studio engineer, Mariella Bevan. Thanks also to my guests, Isabel Hilton and Samuel McDowell. Monocle on Saturday will return at the same time next weekend. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.